H, Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm David Chittenden.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO's News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Hannah Francis. Today, I'm joined by Street Roots freelance reporter Madeline Voth to talk about her latest article. Is social housing the answer to combating Portland's housing crisis? An innovative model for publicly funded housing is thriving in some cities in Europe. Seattle has pledged to adopt it. Will Portland be next? Hi, Madeline. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, yes, of course. I'm so happy to be here.
Awesome. Happy to have you. So let's just start off real basic. What is social housing that you're talking about here?
Yeah, so social housing is kind of a new form of affordable housing, or I guess a different form of affordable housing. It's publicly owned, and it is run by both the tenants and the government. And so it kind of differs from a typical form of affordable housing that we see where developers get tax credits from building affordable housing, and it kind of focuses instead on the tenants themselves, their input, and the actual amount of money that tenants make. So it kind of creates a new form of equitable housing because your rent is based on your income as a tenant in a social housing construct. So this is a lot different because most affordable housing, you know, you're not living with mixed income people. You're kind of all on the same form of income. Social housing, you really are put with many people in many different forms of income, which also creates this kind of checks and balances situation. So people that make, you know, $3,000 a month are paying 30% or less of that, and people who are making $30,000 are paying 30% or less of that. So it kind of creates this more equitable system of housing.
So your article starts with this example of the Laureate in Montgomery County in Maryland. Will you tell me a little about this affordable housing model specifically?
Yeah, so this is kind of the first like tangible form of social housing that we've seen in the United States. Basically, the city of Montgomery County, which is in Maryland, has this like fund. The government has this fund for social housing. And so they built with this fund a place called the Laureate, where, again, as I talked about what social housing actually does, you know, the tenants there, they live in this really beautiful place. Like, if you look up pictures of the Laureate, it's got fireplaces and free hot cocoa machines and pools. And, you know, it's not what you typically think when you think visually of social housing. But they were able to build this model in order for their tenants to experience a publicly owned and tenant-governed place. So they've done two. I forget what the name of the second one is, but I think them as a city, they're kind of really trying to solve the housing crisis with their own housing crisis with this like fund. It does differ a little bit from other models of social housing that we're kind of seeing in Seattle and soon to be hopefully Portland, because it's governed again by this like overarching like sum of money instead of like the general annual government fund that we see in a lot of other places. So yeah, they financed and built it through this $100 million like revolving fund that they have.
Wow, fascinating. Thank you. So you mentioned, right, that Seattle is planning on possibly adopting something like this. Will you tell me a little bit about what they're planning?
Yeah. So they are a bit further in the process than Portland is. They, in February, passed this proposition to fund the Seattle Social Housing Developer. And so this made them the first city to like fully commit verbally and like legislatively to social housing. So I think right now they're kind of then in the next steps of building these funds, and then from there they'll go to actually creating the social housing.
Amazing. So, and then this is a potential option for Portland too. What's our status with that?
So yeah, as I said, Portland is a little bit further behind in the actual implementation of social housing. But in April of this year, City Council unanimously passed a resolution which basically urges like housing experts to study social housing. And then a year from now, they will come back, or I guess a year, May of 2026 is when they'll come back and like come with what they've actually studied. So what I know right now is they're planning a trip to Vienna, Austria to observe social housing there. I'm sure, well, I would imagine they would talk to people also domestically, maybe in Montgomery County and Seattle, and see what's working there. And it kind of is all just to see things that are working in other cities and how we can maybe successfully implement this here. So again, this is something that's still in its infancy, but it's the first step in implementing social housing. So following that, there'll probably be like talks of how are we going to fund this? Who will take part in this more than that? But again, this is like in City Council, they have promised to come back a year from now and give them more of a like detailed plan for the future.
You mentioned costs burdened by rent in your mm-hmm. article. So can you give me a definition of that and speak a little bit about how many Portlanders are experiencing that right now?
Yeah, so cost burdened by rent is you are paying 30% or more of your income to your housing costs. And so this is something that over 50% of households in Portland are experiencing. And then 25% of those are paying, or I guess 25% of Portlanders are paying over half their income of housing. So it's clear that, you know, housing is becoming really unaffordable in this city. And there is quite a burden on people who are just, you know, trying to live and find their housing here. And, you know, like in Vienna, people are spending less than 30%. I think the average is maybe like 25% of their income on housing. And that's something that I think Portland is really trying to get to.
Absolutely. You also mentioned that this could help the homeless crisis here. Could you elaborate a little bit on how this could affect the housing crisis here?
Yeah, absolutely. I think everyone that I spoke to about this social housing implementation kind of talked about the way that this is a way to stop homelessness before it even happens. I mean, obviously we have quite a high amount of homeless population here, but then there's also more people that are going into homelessness each day. And so having something like this, where again, your rent is based on your income, I think allows people to not fall into homelessness in the first place. You know, you're not getting evicted because your rent stays like in tandem with your income. And so like some of the city council members, they said that I talked to said that like we're creating homeless people faster than we're able to house them. And so again, like, yeah, this is the first way in which we can kind of curb that before it even starts.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there anything else that you'd like to add about this story?
I'll just again emphasize the fact that like it is in its infancy. Like this is a very exciting thing that Portland is doing, but they are kind of just starting this process. So I'm not sure when we'll see like tangible outcomes of this. You know, I know funding takes a lot, and so does the actual building of housing. So I'm hoping in the next few years we'll see something. But again, like this study will take the whole year, and then May 2026 onwards is when, you know, we're going to start building the actual blocks of implementing this into tangible things.
You've been listening to an in-depth interview with Street Roots freelance reporter Madeline Voth talking about her latest article about social housing. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Hannah Francis.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. Despite all the attention focused on Iran and its potential for building nuclear weapons, the fact remains that the only power in the Middle East that has nuclear weapons is Israel. But how much is really known about the Israeli nuclear program? KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with longtime activist and writer John Steinbeck, the co-founder of the Hiroshima-Nagasaki Peace Committee of the National Capital Area. When the fighting between Israel and Iran first started, before the U.S. bombed Iranian nuclear sites, and before the ceasefire was announced.
There's some controversy about exactly how many nuclear weapons Israel has. What's your sense of that? Is it 100? Is it closer to 400? Or somewhere in between?
The estimates range from 80. Federation of American Scientists says 80. Others, Seymour Hersh and others, say up to 500. My position is it really doesn't make a difference. According to Frank Barnaby and Ted Taylor, Israel has nuclear weapons. It probably has neutron bombs, and it has miniaturized nukes. It has ballistic missiles that can reach Moscow. The Jericho 3 can reach New York City, and it has five or six German submarines. And it has bombers that can target the entire Middle East. So considering that one tiny primitive nuclear bomb detonated over Hiroshima killed approximately 200,000 people and obliterated all structures from ground zero out to 2.5 kilometers, and that the modern weapons are 10 times and 100 times and even 1,000 times bigger than that, I don't think it really matters whether Israel has 80 or whether it has 500.
And yet all the talk in the Western media is about the possibility of Iran gaining a nuclear weapon. Why do you think that is?
Well, Iran is a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which obliges it not to have nuclear weapons. It has repeatedly said that it does not want to have nuclear weapons. Furthermore, it joined the joint JCPOA, the Iran Nuclear Agreement, which further opened up its facilities. So the IAEA had access to virtually all of Iran's military facilities. And, you know, there's great suspicion in Iran right now that the IAEA spies basically gave Israel a lot of targeting information. So Iran is the most examined, most studied nation on the earth regarding its nuclear program, and Israel is not a signatory to the NPT, and basically there's no oversight at all. So it's absolutely the height of hypocrisy that the villain here is Iran because of some theoretical possibility that it might have nukes, whereas Israel has an entire arsenal of sophisticated modern hydrogen bombs.
So decades have passed, and the U.S. has known about the Israeli nuclear program and yet hasn't really done anything about it, although, as some people have pointed out, the Kennedy administration did try to do something or was thinking of doing something about it. So why haven't U.S. leaders taken a stronger action about this?
Yeah, not just Kennedy, Eisenhower as well. When Israel built Dimona, or the French built Dimona for Israel, Eisenhower was very, very concerned about it. And he and Kennedy had conferences about it. And it was a number one priority of both Eisenhower and Kennedy that Israel never get nuclear weapons. And so Israel agreed to the U.S. sending an inspection team to Dimona. And so the team went there. Unbeknownst to them, Israel had purchased an entirely new second control center, which they installed and in order to try to persuade the visiting Americans that it was a civilian program and not a nuclear program. So Israel went to extreme lengths, but then Kennedy was assassinated. Johnson came to power. Johnson was much more friendly, much more ambivalent about the nuclear program. And then Golda Meir and Nixon made the deal that resulted in what we have today, which is what Israel calls nuclear ambiguity. But it's an open secret, and everyone knows about nuclear Israel's nuclear weapons.
So on the issue of Israel kind of playing the U.S. On the issue, or even blackmailing the U.S., what would you say about that?
Well, so Shimon Peres, who was, could be considered the father of the Israeli bomb, he and David Bergman were the two founders back in the late 1940s. He called this strategy of using the Israeli bomb a non-conventional compellent. And the idea was that Israel would use its nuclear weapons in order to coerce the surrounding nations, the Arab nations, to do what they wanted to do, and also to coerce the United States what it wanted to do. So Seymour Hersh, Mark Gaffney, and others have reported that in 1973, during the Israeli-Arab War, 1973, when Israel was on the verge of defeat, Israel used the threat of using nuclear weapons in order to compel, you know, Kissinger and Nixon. And reluctantly, Kissinger and Nixon airlifted that material in. So it's fairly well documented. So Israel has a long history of using the threat of nukes, both against the United States and also against its surrounding neighbors, to basically to get what it wants.
So now we have, in recent days, the Israeli attack on Iran and Iran's response. Could this escalate into some sort of nuclear war, at least on the part of Israel?
Oh, yeah. No, it could easily. And you know, as we're speaking, reports have come out that the United States has in the process, as we're talking in the air, has sent something like 40 to 60 large tanker planes to the Middle East, which would be used to fuel Israeli jets. So the great concern is the U.S. is going to involve itself directly in this war on behalf of Israel. And so this creates a situation which, in my opinion, brings us back to the 1962 and the Cuban Missile Crisis, and maybe even more acute, because back then there was a red line between Kennedy and Khrushchev, and talks went on, and disaster was averted. And this time around, it's not clear to me, you know, what if the United States involves itself and Iran is facing existential an existential threat and deploys all of the ballistic missiles that apparently has against Israel, it would be devastating. I mean, we can see some results of the attack yesterday. It seems that Israel suffered some really, really major losses, including at least one major oil refinery. And that was just the preliminary exchange. So I think we're on the, both here and also in Ukraine, you know, we're on the, in territory that we really haven't seen since 1962.
So you mentioned the planes, U.S. planes can refuel the Israeli jets. Is that similar to what the U.S. did for the Saudis when they were bombing Yemen?
Oh, yes. No, the U.S. has a long history of doing this. But what makes this different is, and these are reports that I'm reading right now within the last few hours, this is an unprecedented operation sending these tanker planes to the Middle East. So hopefully it does not mean the U.S. is going to get involved. If the U.S. gets involved directly, then it's going to mean essentially the closing of the Strait of Hormuz. It's going to put all of the oil facilities, Iranian and Saudi and all the Gulf states, all of the oil facilities in at risk. It'll result in cataclysm in the financial markets. It'll result in God knows what oil crisis. So and effectively will probably mean the end of the Trump presidency. And I know a lot of people, they don't like Trump, but this is a heck of a way to end it. And it could end it for all of us. That's the big problem.
Yeah, you'd think that Trump would want to be the deal maker here, and you'd think that maybe he would be pissed off at Israel for ruining the deal that he's trying to make with Iran, but that doesn't seem to be the case. What's going on there?
Well, he's brought a lot, like he did his first term, he's brought a lot of the neocons. He didn't bring in Bolton, but he brought in Rubio and Zeth and a few others as well. So my guess is that saner voices in the Pentagon, because the Pentagon in these cases tends to be the saner voices, hopefully are on the phone with him and saying, you've got to back away, because this really is the precipice. This is the edge. Because if Iran falls, then Iran shares a 1,000-mile or so border with Russia, and it's going to be, at the very least, very disadvantageous to Russia. And so I'm sure that Russia and China and India and others, Pakistan's Senate yesterday unanimously issued a statement saying that they stand in solidarity with and defense of Iran. So things have spiraled out of control, and we just hope that saner heads prevail. But, essentially in Israel right now, we have what amounts to a rogue state that's run by devotees of Meir Kahana. So it's just not a very optimistic situation.
Is it true that some Israeli nuclear scientists are calling for the nuclear program to be shut down?
Well, several of the nuclear scientists over the years have expressed great skepticism of it. And, Abner Cohen in particular wrote a book about it, about exposing the secrets. So, and Seymour Hersh wrote the book, The Samson Option. That's the definitive book on Israel's nuclear program. And he's unequivocal that, it may in the beginning in Ben-Gurion's and Peres's mind been that this is going to be the thing that's going to prevent another Holocaust, but he points out that it's vastly beyond that. And Israel has for 50 years now been using nuclear weapons as a part of their integrated policy, diplomatic and military policies. So this was entirely unavoidable. And I think a lot of us thought that it was just so crazy, the idea that Israel would attack Iran, that they would never do it. But here we are.
Yeah, it seemed like they were, for years, or Netanyahu in particular, was urging the U.S. to do it.
Yes, and it has been, attacking Iran from the beginning. I mean, that's been his whole policy, that, and also the policy of, trying to divide and conquer the Palestinians. It was Netanyahu and Likud that were largely responsible for, at least initially, undercover supporting Hamas as a counter to Fatah, and they were quite successful, I think, in dividing the Palestinian resistance in that way. And then, of course, just like the way that, bin Laden blew up in the CIA's face, Hamas has blown up in Israel's face, so... There's that as well. I mean, it's a very difficult situation. Your listenership needs to understand how critical this situation is, and do what you can do, but don't be distracted. But this is a very serious, serious situation.
So it seems like the Israelis, or the leadership of Israel right now, thinks that they can just wipe out all enemies in one fell swoop and be done with the whole conflict? Do you get that impression?
Yeah. So, if you go back to the 1980s and 90s, Israel Shahak, back in those days, there was the Jerusalem Times was almost the only English language Israeli newspaper. And so Shahak would translate the Hebrew press, the Haaretz and the others as well. And he warned us back in the 80s and in the early 90s that some of the extremists, some of the religious extremists and political extremists, the Kahanists, if you will, were rapidly encroaching in the political leadership and also in the military leadership. So, the old Labor Party of Ben-Gurion and Perez and so on, that functionally doesn't exist anymore. Today it is the Likud party of the moderates, more or less, and you have these various Kahanist parties that occupy very high positions in the Israeli government. And for all practical purposes, Mayor Kahana and his people are running Israel now, in my opinion.
Yeah, it's weird to think that the Likud are the moderates. That's where Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir came out of, right? And they were in these organizations that were considered terrorists even by the mainstream Zionist movement, right?
Well, in Britain, King David Hotel and other things as well. But, I try to tell family and friends that, in some sense, Netanyahu, it really is the moderate, because the people that he's made the deal with the devil with that are in his government, the Lieberman and Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and others that are even worse than they are. These people are, for all practical purposes, are unreconstructed fashion. And that also makes this a much more difficult situation, because you have an Israeli government that's seemingly deranged, and then you've got the United States and Europe that are, largely seem to be, out of touch with reality. And it's not a good situation, not a healthy situation. And then, of course, there's always the situation in Ukraine, and how could that go? Ukraine attacks the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant, and there's a massive meltdown. These are really dire times, and we need to focus on what the reality is. And we haven't even mentioned Gaza.
Yeah, you think people's attention is shifting now?
Yeah, no, and this is all people need to understand, that they need to educate themselves about the nuclear program. I wrote a paper back in 2008 called Israel's Nuclear Program, and it's available in the Internet Archive site. So if you look up Steinbach and Israel's Nuclear Arsenal, quite a long paper. It's about 11,000 words, and kind of will tell you everything from the beginning in 1948 to up to more or less the present day.
Right. Yeah. You talked about the help that they got from the French and the South Africans later on. Yeah.
This paper was paid for, so I have a library of books relating to Israel's nuclear program, and it was paid for by the UAE, because it was the UAE government that came across an earlier paper of mine, and they commissioned me to write this paper. And I talked to some of my friends, Arjun Makajani in particular, and said, our nuclear energy security conference, and should I write it? And he encouraged me to do it, so I did, and it was well received in Abu Dhabi, and so it's still out there. I'm glad I had the opportunity to write it, and just I want to encourage the listeners, be informed, be aware of what's going on.
Maybe someone in the Trump administration will read it, who knows?
Like I said, I suspect people in the Pentagon are trying to get on the phone with Trump, and then there is Tulsi Gabbard, who I'm told is being vilified on MSNBC as being, a traitor and so on. But, she is, one of the few relatively sane voices, in my opinion. And she certainly is consciously aware of everything that we're talking about.
That's veteran activist and writer John Steinbeck speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg for KABU News in Depth.
Granny D. I'm talking from KBOO, Portland. I come from Dublin, New Hampshire, and I go across the country working for public funding at the state level. And I often hear about KBOO on my